Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580, our talk show for the morning. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Travis Stansel, and at the controls is Henry Frayne. Tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour, our monthly visit with Dr. Robert Bocek. He is a pediatrician, and he is on the program every month, always on a Thursday, to answer questions about children's health. That's hour one. Hour two, we will be talking about climate change in the Great Lakes region. And there, our guest will be Catherine Hayhoe, co-author of the Great Lakes Climate Change Report. She's an independent research consultant who specializes in the interface between science and public policy. That will be tomorrow. And she also will be giving a talk here in the area. So if you're interested in hearing from her, we'll give you that information on the program tomorrow. That's in the 11 o'clock hour. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon with 10 different topics for you each week. We always welcome your questions and comments. In this part of Focus, we will be talking about a little-known corner of American history that is part of the history of the South, of the Civil War, and of slavery. And our guest for the program is Edward Jones. He's authored a novel, his first, which has just recently been published. It's titled The Known World, and it's published by Amistad, which is an imprint of HarperCollins. It is a book that is about black people who owned black people in the South before the Civil War. There were not a lot of black slaveholders in this country, but indeed there were some. And he uses that as a way of talking about the larger issue of slavery and what it means for one person to own another. The book is getting a lot of attention. In fact, we're told he's just found out that it's been nominated for the National Book Award. He's the author of a collection of stories, Lost in the City. That was a finalist for the National Book Award. He's got some other recognition for his writing, including the Penn Hemingway Award. He is talking with us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers to call. Mr. Jones, hello.
Yes. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks, and thanks for talking with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Well, congratulations on your nomination for the book award. That's great.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And
I know you're in the middle of what I looked at your tour schedule. It looks pretty long. Are you getting tired yet?
No. You know, I haven't done very much traveling, and all the places I've been so far, I've never seen. I was in Chicago last week. I'd never been to Illinois before. I was in Iowa. Yeah, I'm getting to see part of the country, although on a limited basis, that I've never seen before. Yeah. I'm happy about that.
And I'm sure that when this subject comes up, when people look at the book, they realize what the story is about. There will be some surprise, I would imagine, at the idea of black slave owners. There apparently weren't a lot of them, but they did exist. What actually do we know about the numbers of black people who had slaves?
Yeah, I don't know what the numbers are, because my plan before I sat down to write the novel was to read a number of books, including, I think there are two on black people who did own slaves, but I never got around to doing any of that sort of research, so I can't give you numbers. I don't think that there were black slave owners in every slaveholding state in the South. I think there may have been three or four, perhaps. Mm-hmm. That's what I've heard since the book came out.
And the story that I have read about how you came across this fact that this was a number of years ago, I guess it was when you were in college, you came across just a very brief reference to the fact that there were some, and that you had been kind of carrying that around with you for a long time, and did at some point you finally think, now this is really we can build a story on that fact.
I think that's exactly how it was. I came across it, the fact, when I was in college, and I don't remember if a professor mentioned it or if it was some footnote in some book I read. But I simply filed it away, because at that time in my life I had no plans to become a writer. I entered college as a math major, and after that first semester I went on to major in English. But I still didn't have any plans to become a writer. It was only later, much later, after I was in the last stages of writing my first book, that the idea of black people owning slaves, it came to the forefront of my brain. And I began composing this world that became Manchester County.
Mm-hmm. So the setting is totally fictional. The people are all fictional.
Yes,
And yet we know those people like that did exist.
Yeah, I'm not sure, you know, and it's as far as real historical figures, who they are, who they were, and everything. I don't know anything about that. But I think one of the things that happened to me is that once I knew that it was a fact that black people had owned slaves, that, without my even knowing it, sort of gave me license to create my own slaveholders in my own imagination. I think that if there had never been any black people who owned slaves, I don't think I would have went on to create the world that's in the known world, the world where black people owned slaves. But I think once I came across that fact, then that opened up, that gave me sort of license to do what I did.
Well, the central character really here is a man named Henry Townsend, who was born a slave, and his father and mother were slaves, who managed to work to purchase their own freedom. First, the father purchased his. Then he purchased the freedom of his wife. Then he purchased the freedom of his son.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about this man, Henry Townsend, the character Henry Townsend.
Well, I think that the problem for Henry, I think, is in those years, especially after his mother got her freedom, he was sort of left to William Robbins, who is a white slave owner who owned him. And he became the groom to William Robbins, and William Robbins developed a certain affection for him. So in a certain sense, what happened is that because Henry's real parents were only allowed to come on Sunday, the rest of the week he was under the influence of William Robbins. And I think he took his guide as to how to live his life from this man. And I don't think that would have been the case if, for example, his father purchased his freedom first and then the wife after that. But for all those years when he didn't have parents, his father, in a certain sense, became William Robbins. Mm.
It's a very interesting relationship, a very interesting and complicated relationship here between Henry and William Robbins.
Yes.
That, in a sense, in a very real sense, I think for Henry, Robbins becomes a kind of a mentor.
Yes.
And that for Robbins, he, you know, in the language of our day, it seems that he is trying to inculcate in Henry a kind of entrepreneurial spirit.
Yes, he does.
And
yes,
sees him to says to him, well, you can make something of yourself. You can be successful. You can have wealth.
Yeah.
And that part of the deal there is for you to, it seems that like it was so much a part of the economic system. He said to him, Henry, you know, part of the deal is you have to have slaves.
Yeah, you have to. Yeah, and you have to know how to treat the slaves. One of the there's one moment in the novel when Henry has purchased from William Robbins his first slave, Moses, and Moses and Henry are building Henry's house, and they've taken a break and they're sort of tussling there in the dirt, and William Robbins comes upon them and he pulls Henry aside, and he gives him this speech that there has to be this line between slave and the slave owner, and that in doing things like tussling around in the dirt, Henry has told the slave that there is no line. And he has to learn that there has to be always, always a line. The thing, I think, is that William Robbins is rather complicated. I mean, he's in love with a black woman, his mistress, and he's had two children by her, whom he also loves. So he has certain rules and regulations about how to live his life as a slave owner, and yet here and there he himself crossed the line.
Yeah, and that's a very pivotal point in the story, and at that moment then it changes the way that Henry relates to Moses.
It does. It does.
It perhaps completely changes the way Henry thinks about who he is.
Yes.
As a free person in relation to persons who are not free, it's I guess it really gets at the central question of, well, you know, how it is that in your mind you justify owning another person, and how it is we draw those lines. And you could, in a sense, you can understand how the white people justified this, because yeah. they say, well, you know, yeah. we're white and they're black, and somehow that,
and the law says we can do it.
Yeah, and there's a legal underpinning, there's an economic underpinning, there's a religious moral underpinnings that allows them to justify all that, and there is of course this fundamental, although superficial, difference between the two that allows the white slave owner to do that. But then the big question you have to ask about this character is, well, how can he do that? How can he look at the slave and look at, you know, himself, and, you know, where, how then does he make the justification for owning that other person?
Yeah, I think he follows the line for the most part that the white people followed. You sort of have to just turn your head away from what is right and good, you know, and you have to just keep telling yourself, the law says I can do this, the Bible says I can do this, so therefore I will do this. And that, I think, is the case with Henry. It's the case with a lot of the other black slave owners, for Nelson, the teacher, for example. They, you know, you get up in the morning and you have to tell yourself, well, the world says it's okay for me to do this bad thing, and therefore I will do it. And I think that's why they're all flawed, because there is a right way, a righteous way to do something, and they have simply turned their backs on that.
And that really, I guess, is the key idea of the book, that is that how maybe, you know, so much of us and so much of our life don't challenge the established notions, the things that you know, it's so easy for us to say, well, why are we doing what we do? We say, well, because everybody does that.
Yeah.
And in fact, you know, this causes that Henry buying this slave causes a rift between him and Henry and his father.
Yes.
And his father sort of looks at Henry as if to, you know, almost as if he doesn't have to say it. As if, how could you, you know, given who we are, given our experience, given what we've been, given where we've come from, how can you do this?
Yeah.
And Henry just says, well, you know, he says to his father, I haven't done anything I don't have a right to.
White people
to. And then he says, yeah, I ain't done nothing no white man wouldn't do. So it sort of said, well, it's like you said, so the law says I can do this. We're doing that. Everybody else does this. So, I mean, what's wrong about what I'm doing? Just because I'm black, why is that wrong?
And I presented them, white and black, against a lot of people who chose, starting with Henry's father and mother, who said, well, yeah, the law says I can do it, but my heart says I should not do it, and therefore I won't. And that's the case with the white sheriff of the county, John Skiffington. He, you know, he knows he has a right to own slaves, but he has chosen simply not to do it. I live in the state of Virginia, and one of the heroes here is Thomas Jefferson, who did own slaves. And a lot of people here worship him. But I've never really been able to follow that, because I think if in this state when Jefferson was alive, if there had been no people who could have owned slaves, who had gone, the thing I'm trying to say, I suppose, is that there are people who chose not to own slaves, and Jefferson did. He went down the wrong road, and so I can't really worship him the way a lot of other people in this state are worshiping him. Because there are a lot of other people who didn't have much as he had, who simply said, it's not the right thing to do, and therefore I will not do it. Mm.
I think also that maybe perhaps Henry has in his mind that treating the slaves well somehow excuses or makes up for the fact that you have them at all.
Yeah.
And that goes back to this idea that I think probably continues to be perpetrated, that you know, maybe there were, that overall slavery was bad.
Yeah.
But that within slavery there were good slave owners and there were bad slave owners, and that somehow that makes a difference.
Yeah, no. In the end, so Henry says something about I'm going to be the best master there has ever been, better than any white man has ever been. But what he doesn't seem to understand is that it's all, as I write, it's all doomed from the very first time he even thinks the thought of owning a slave. You know, because it's a system of people owning people. And there is no right way to do that, you know. It's sort of like one devil has died, another devil comes along and says, I'm going to be a far, far better devil than the other devil. Well, we're talking about hell. And so, you know, there isn't any right way to do that.
Let me introduce again our guest for this part of the show. We're talking with Edward Jones, Edward P. Jones. He is a writer. He already has published a well-received collection of stories, Lost in the City, the book that was nominated for the National Book Award. His first novel is recently published. That's the book here we're talking about this morning. It's titled The Known World, and it is published by Amistad, which is an imprint of HarperCollins. And he just found out that it has been nominated for a National Book Award. So you might want to look at it. It's out there in the bookstores now. And questions are welcome, too. You want to be a part of the conversation. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. I think it's, too, the important notion here that is suggested by the title, as we've talked a little bit, too, about, that is how easy it is to accept the boundaries of your world and say, well, that's the way it is.
Yeah.
And how difficult it can be to challenge them or to say, well, there is more to the world than this. I mean, this world that I have known until now, surely there must be more. Mm. And the difference between people who live within their known world and those who say, well, this is not enough. I'm not going to be constrained by this. I'm going to cross the boundary and see where I go.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah. Yeah, that there are two people that I think of in the novel. There is the black overseer Moses, who essentially has just confined his entire world to the plantation that he's the overseer of. And that is one thing that dooms him in the end, because he doesn't know, he's chosen not to know anything beyond the plantation. And that's also the case with John Skiffington, the sheriff. He's the very symbol of the law there in Manchester County. And while he has chosen not to own slaves, at the same time, he's doing the bidding of what I call the Caesars of Manchester County, the people who essentially are in charge of the place. And those people all own slaves. So when it comes down to this moral code that John Skiffington has, he bends the moral code whenever a Caesar wants him to bend it.
Yeah, I guess that gets at the issue of if you participate in a bad system, even if you don't participate directly. So, what sort of responsibility do you have? Now, I suppose one could also make the argument that it would have been to buck the system at that time.
Yeah.
would have been extremely difficult, if not impossible, you know, particularly if you were a person in that society that was not one of the people who had the power and had the money for you to say, well, somehow this is wrong and we need to change this.
Simply
would have just not been possible.
No, absolutely not. No. But I think there are small things that people, you know, could do. I mean, there's Celeste, who was a slave on Henry's plantation. Her small way of getting through is never to use the word master or mistress. And she's crippled, and so there's not, you know, and she's a slave. So there's not a whole lot she can do. There's small things that people try to do. There is one of the slave patrollers. The slave patrollers are people that essentially their job was to find runaway slaves. And there is a man, Barnum Kinsey, and I describe him as an alcoholic. But he tries in his own small way to do right, you know. But I think essentially the system is, it bears down on the heads of every single person, good and bad. And so no one really can fight beyond that. Because it's not just in Manchester County, of course. It was in the state of Virginia. It was in the entire country, you know, the system of slavery.
You talked a little bit about the fact that, and some of the things that I've read about you writing the book, that you did do some research, did some reading on the history of slavery.
Yes.
But that you didn't want to, I think I read a quote, something to the effect that you didn't want the facts to get in the way of a good story.
Yeah.
And I can understand that, and I think that that's an interesting, you know, to talk with writers about how you draw that line, because on the one hand, you want the story to have a kind of credibility. You want people to buy into it.
Right.
And I think also, you know, some of the historians who have looked at your book said that substantially you got it right.
Yes.
At the same time, as a writer, you are interested in telling a story, and you don't want to be weighed down by an obligation to historic fact. And I guess I just wonder how it is you draw that line, and how it is you you walk it, and what sort of license you feel that you have to make things up in the service of the story, while at the same time having some respect for history.
Right. Yeah. My major concern always, first and last, was character. You know? And I felt that if I could present the reader with a credible, a vivid characters, then that the job was 75-80% done. Now, when I started out after I was in the last stages of writing the first book, when the idea of the known world came to me, I already had about 40 or so books on slavery that I had never gotten around to reading. And my plan was to read all of those books and then sit down and write my novel. And the thing is that from 1992 on, I would read a chapter or so in one book or so, and I never got beyond, say, the third or fourth chapter. I'm not sure why that is. I think part of it was just being distracted. I had a day job, and so I wasn't, hungry. And I think also I just simply wasn't moved to finish those books. So by the time I got around to writing in 2001, what I had, because I kept saying, well, you can't really write until you do all the research. But I did, I think I would get sort of jazzed up. And the result of that was that I did have 6 pages of the first chapter and 6 pages of the final chapter. When I sat down around Christmas 2001, that was all I had in terms of hard copy. Everything else was in my head because I kept waiting for the day when I would sit down and do all the research. But what happened is that when the vacation time came with this day job, I had 5 weeks. I said, all right, this is the time when you have to start working. And I looked at the 2 shelves of books, and I knew there was no way I had anything in me that would allow me to sit down and spend weeks, perhaps months, perhaps a year, reading all of those books. But what I knew I had was a novel full of characters that I felt were very real. And I also had the things that I had learned along the way. I'd read books in college. I had seen Roots. You know, I had read the autobiography of Miss Jane Bidman. I had seen Cicely Tyson in that movie. I had seen a few other movies along the way. So I had a sense of what that world looked like, you know, from all of the stuff that I had simply accumulated without doing any research. And I said, well, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to go on what I've learned in my life and use that. One of the books I have is a book on the architecture of that time, the slave cabins, the mansions that the masters lived in and everything. I never got around to reading that, fortunately, unfortunately. But in the first pages of The Known World, there is a slave, Elias, who's sitting at 9 o'clock at night in the dark with just a lantern to go by, and he's carving a doll for his daughter. And Elias is a man who thought that he would one day run away to freedom. You know, he lived his life not caring for any human being because freedom was all he wanted. But lo and behold, he fell in love with Celeste, who's a crippled woman, and they have children. And what I wanted to show there was what this man had sort of lost in not finding freedom, but what he had gained in finding this woman and having those children. And I present him in the first pages. You see him there carving this doll, and he's sitting in front of his cabin. Now, had I read this book on slave architecture, I could have told you in 2 or 3 pages how his cabin was made, what went into it, how long it took, and everything else. But because I was interested in character, what I wanted to do was present before you Elias and the man who he is, and say, Elias is sitting carving a doll in front of his cabin. I will give you Elias, and then you yourself can see what his cabin is based on what you've learned in your life. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it makes perfect sense. Yeah.
My concern was totally with character. And all the other things, the background things, you know, the research that I could have done, that was a concern, but not as much as a concern as presenting character.
It's an amazing what you've done here with this, being able to do this kind of writing, this writing as fiction. I'm thinking about the job that you had before when you were writing for the tax newsletter. But it seems like it's such a departure. This was something like you were, it was a newsletter about tax policy, and so what you had to do was look at various articles about tax law and summarize, sort of distill them, summarize them for people who would then get the short, you know, the thumbnail sketch version of that.
Yeah.
And so you went from that to this. that must have been, I would think a relief, but also a strange sort of jarring kind of thing. Or maybe it wasn't.
Well, I didn't, luckily for me, I didn't really have to delve too far. I mean, because what I was taking was op-eds and columns and articles and everything that someone else had already written. So all I had to do was distill, you know, basic facts. So I was sort of safe from that. I didn't really learn a great deal about taxes because it never really interested me. I think if I had had to be a reporter and had to do first-hand stuff, I think that would have killed me. The strange thing, though, is that I did have those 5 weeks of vacation, and I was about 2 weeks into writing The Known World when they called me and said that I didn't have a job anymore after almost 19 years.
Wow.
When I started writing, I said, well, I'm going to try to do 5 pages every day. And I was going along, and that day they called me. I'll never forget, it was Tuesday, January 8th, 2002, about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And I had done my 5 or so pages for that day. And I think I had a certain hope and belief in the work that I was doing. And the next day, even though I was hurting after losing this job that I had so for so long, I got up and went on to do my 5 pages the next day, the Wednesday.
Well, it somehow that you managed to get it to work for you, because this book seemed to come in a relatively short period of time.
Yeah, it did. It did. And that's because while I was saying to myself, okay, we can't do any writing until we do the research, in all those years I was working this book out in my head. I knew what the first line would be. I knew all the way to the very last line. I knew what the last line would be. I knew, you know, the stories, the characters, the plot, you know, and especially, and I was very proud of myself for this, I knew what the final chapter would be, because in so many novels I read, the first two-thirds, the novel is wonderful, and then the second, and the last third, it falls flat. And so I wanted that final chapter to be accumulation of everything that had gone on prior to that. I wanted to sort of, as if I was able to wow the reader. And my hope is that I've succeeded in that. Yeah, it did. It took me, actually, I started, like I said, a few days after Christmas. And because I'd been working on it for about 10 years in my head, 2.5 months later, the middle of March, I had done the first draft.
You know, I just thinking about something that you just said about the fact that there are, you know, one, you come across novels that start very promising.
Yes.
And go very strong, and then somehow something happens, and you don't know whether... Did the writer get tired?
Yeah.
Did they run out of ideas? Did they not quite have a sense where the story was going to go? For some reason the end was very unsatisfying. As if he or she came to a point where you said, "Well, I think I have to end the story, and I don't really quite know how to do it." Not being a writer, I have never been in that place. But I wonder if you have some kind of sense of what happens to in the course of telling a story, that suddenly you get to the point where maybe you say, wait a minute, I'm not sure where to go from here.
What you just said, I think it's a combination of all of those, and of course it depends on the particular writer. Mm-hmm. And I think it might happen to a lot of writers to say, well, I sit down and I just let the characters take over. You know, I just find that I could never accept something like that. You know, whether you're a good writer or a bad writer, for me, the characters never take over. You're always the master of what you're doing, as it were. And I think people sort of, they start out with a wonderful idea, you know, it's grand, you know, and someone tells them, oh, that's great. But they don't know what those last pages will be. They don't know what the climax of all of that. They don't know what the result of all the pages before that, what's going to happen, you know. You spent your time preparing all of these fireworks, and yet you forgot to bring a match, you know, and it just sort of fizzles out. I didn't want that to happen to me, you know. And I as I was building the novel in my head, I could see where everyone was going to be in those final chapters, you know. And I wanted what happened to them to be the logical result of everything that I had written before that, you know. I really, really thought long and hard about that final chapter, because I was aware of that. I was aware of books that in the final third, things just sort of fizzled out because they run out of inspiration. You know, they run out of energy because they don't have a plan. Because I had a plan, you know, I knew, I sometimes tell my students when I'm teaching creative writing, is that, you know, the plan is to get from Washington to Baltimore. You may deviate, you know, you may see a road that takes you someplace else, but your ultimate goal is to be in Baltimore. And I think a lot of people start out and going, and they don't know where they're going to end up. So you can sort of go any road you want to go, but ultimately you have to be in Baltimore. And that was my final chapter, Baltimore.
Our guest is Edward Jones. His new novel, it's getting a lot of positive attention, is The Known World. It is out now. It's published by Amistad, which is an imprint of HarperCollins, and it has been nominated for a National Book Award. He's also produced a collection of stories, Lost in the City, that was a finalist for the National Book Award. And questions, comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. This, The Known World, is an historical novel, and I think it's interesting that... There's something about it that has a period feel, except that it's not. I'm sure as a writer, you could sit down and you could intend to write something that read like it had been written before the Civil War, or you could write something that was set before the Civil War that was completely modern novel in its sensibilities and its language, and or I guess you could do something in between. And I think that this novel has an interesting sort of feeling about it that places it in its time, and yet it's not so obvious that I think readers are struggling with something that doesn't feel contemporary. And I guess I wonder how you approach that, and whether there was some sort of deliberate attention to detail, to language, to form that helps place the reader in the time.
I didn't set out with anything sort of deliberate. I think if you tell a reader this is 1855 Virginia, then the reader will follow you and believe you, as long as you don't, for example, have someone say, you know, in the midst of a fight, "All right, everyone calm down, everyone be cool." You know, you know what I mean?
Yes,
you know,
yes.
As long as you don't do something like that, then the reader will follow you. As long as the road is smooth, you know, and there are no boulders, there are no pebbles in the road, then the reader will go along with you. And I was always aware that I didn't always know how someone in 1855 Virginia would have spoken, but I knew some of the things that they would not say. Mm-hmm. There's a point there where I made up a word, a glumpin. And what it is that this man is, it's sort of, glumping is what's the matter, you know, with you. Now, that's my own invention. And it's not a 20th century word, it's not a 21st century word, but it does sort of sound like it would come out of the mouth of someone in the 19th century. You know, the guy asks another guy, "What's a glumping with you, fellow?" So as long as you know, as long as as long as the road is smooth, then the reader will follow. You know, I was aware that I hadn't done a lot of research about things, but that really wasn't my concern. As long as I could present the character as best as I possibly could, then I was okay. You know, that's the whole thing. You know, you say it's 1855 Virginia, and the reader will believe you.
Something else, you know, I guess I've asked the same question. I probably ask the same question of any time I talk with someone who writes historical fiction. But I think it can yield interesting results. And the question goes something like this. I think one of the things that we know about historical fiction is that it's both about the time in which it's set, and it's also about the time in which it's being written.
Yes.
And in fact, it may in a lot of ways be much more about the time that it's being written,
yes,
than the time that it's being set. So,
yeah.
So having said all that, in what ways do you think is The Known World about now?
Yeah, I think the thing about America is that there hasn't any really been any great, you know, discussion about slavery. You know, the way, for example, people all over the world have talked about the Holocaust. You know, how this happened, how we can not have this happen again. But I think slavery came and then it went, and people sort of went on with their lives. I think one of the things I did in the novel is that I will sort of jump ahead into the future beyond 1855 and talk about things in the 1990s, for example. Someone wrote this book, I'll say, an invented book, by the way, about the people, the generations that came after Celeste and Elias, the slave couple. And I think what it is that I was writing in 2001, 2002, more than 150 years after slavery, and I've begun to realize is that I, without my knowing it then, is that I was the kind of god of this whole world. I knew when someone was born, I knew when someone was going to die, and I felt a kind of obligation to the reader to sometimes let them know when that what happened to that person. I don't do it with everyone, but certainly with some of the people that I had a certain affection for. I think that if I were writing, say, this novel in 1875, I don't think I would have been able to do that. But I was more than 150 years into the future, and I was able to say certain things about the legacy of slavery that, of course, I couldn't have said if I were writing in 1875. It was just a really different sort of feeling when I was writing it. I was aware of all the time that had gone by. You know, I could say, for example, in 1912, that the courthouse where all the legal records were held, it burned down in 1912. You know, something I couldn't have said if I were writing a few years after everything in the novel had happened.
We have a couple of callers here, and would certainly people who've been listening would like to join in the conversation. That's welcome. If you're in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455 is the number. Also, we do have a toll-free line, so around Illinois, Indiana, if you might be listening over the air, or if you would happen to be listening on the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, you may also use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. We have for a couple of callers here. The first is in Chicago, and that's on line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I've never heard anybody really talk about this before, and I was wondering what you felt. To me, what was just a bigger tragedy, maybe even more, was the way the slaves were released. In other words, they were totally socially inept and just thrown out in the street, so to speak, and it's like survive and without education proper and the ability to do anything. I mean, that's probably been one of the biggest obstacles that black people have had in the last 150 years is just to overcome that auspicious beginning.
Yeah, I think to a great extent that's true, you know, because, of course, the former masters weren't inclined to help them in any way. And the North, which is still fighting a war, they didn't know how to go about doing any of this. And so you have, you know, so many people who had lived in bondage, you know, who had been told how to live their lives, and all of a sudden they had to sort of fend for themselves. And it was quite difficult. And a lot of that still, you know, it went on. What had happened to them, it continued on into the 20th century. So, yes, it's true. But at the same time, there are certain people who say, well, because they really didn't know what freedom was all about, then they were better as slaves. Well, of course, I can't subscribe to that notion.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
But the thing of it is, prejudice already is in a direction of less than. And then what happens is you're thrown out into the street, and you don't have the equipment to even survive, you know, to survive or
yes,
properly or socially.
Yeah. Yeah, and a lot of people weren't given their 40 acres and a mule.
Right, yeah, and so what happens is this prejudice keeps going like you're just a stupid idiot.
Yes.
Not taking into consideration that they have taught things.
Yeah, exactly, sir. You're right. Correct.
Okay. Well, thank you.
All right, thanks.
Thank you.
And I think it's, you know, you see the reliance on, again, maybe going back to the notion of the known world, the reliance on the known world and the uncertainty when that world changes. In the very beginning of this story, when, you know, we're going back to our talking about the central character and his slaves, what happens right at the beginning of the book is that Henry Townsend dies. And the big question on everybody's mind, all the people that he owned is, well, now what happens to us?
Yeah, yeah.
Even though he has a wife, and presumably she will inherit all his property, and
right.
things could go on, the big, you know, there was no joy in the death of the master, certainly. It was just tossed everything up in the air. Now the question was, well, now what?
Yeah, yeah, because they know, you know, the families, for example, they could each be sold off separately, one here, one there, one over there. So yeah, once this happened, this major thing in their lives, the death of the master, you know, what's going to happen? I present a sort of a tiny little story, a miniature there, about what did happen down the road when the master died, and the wife promised everyone that they would stay together, but she had dreams of living in Paris, and that took money, and so everyone was sold off.
Hmm. We have a caller here in Urbana next, line number one. Hello.
Yes, good morning, Edward.
Yes, sir.
I believe that novelists quite often get closer to the truth than historians do, and so I'm right with you, and I want to read this book. My own particular interest here is in black minstrelsy in the very period that you're writing about, and I recently acquired a collection of songsters from the period, and the woodcut on one of them, Cool White as Dandy Jim, is not done by one of the white comic artists. This has got to be a black woodcut. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about vernacular art, American or black Americana, you know, whatever you want to call it. But I'm just drawing a blank on research, and I'm wondering if you could give me a research tip here.
I'm afraid I'm the last person. You know, I had, like I said, these 40 books, and I think I may have read maybe, of all those 40 books, I read a total of 150 pages. So I'm afraid I'm not the person to go to for that.
All right.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, well...
But there, I'm not on the internet. But for a day and a half, I did have a laptop, and I did see what I had only seen in movies and on television, this internet thing. And for that day and a half, I could see my laptop died on me after a day and a half. By the way, but I'm sure that if you plug in some words, you'll get what you need.
Yeah, I've done that
tried
here.
That.
I'm drawing
yeah.
a blank, but anyway, yeah, and we shouldn't forget the fact that in the period that you're talking about here, that there was also white slavery.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, by 1855, I'm not sure if there were any white slaves, but I think if you're talking about the 1600s, there were indentured servants.
Well, that's correct.
Yes, and that's a fascinating story in itself.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think the thing is that stories are out there that. There have not been as many stories and novels written about slavery as you would think. I think I do know that. And I think as time has gone by, they're still out there waiting to be written.
We just got a couple of minutes left here. I was just interested in your comment about having the laptop for 2 days and it died. I think I also read somewhere about you. Is it true that you don't have a car?
No, I don't. Because I like, when I'm in a car, I like to look around at the world.
Uh-huh.
And I think that would be dangerous. I did get a license when I was in graduate school, and that was because, you know, I got tired of people asking me for ID.
Mm.
So a guy was going to graduate school, and he taught me how to drive. But then when I came back up here in 83 from Charlottesville, Virginia, I never had any desire to have a car. I think one of the things is that... When you grow up poor, you want to keep what little you do have close by. And I don't think I want to own something that I can't bring into my apartment every night.
Well, I'm just thinking about the ways in which, and I'm sure you probably think about the ways in which success could change your life. If you just being nominated for a National Book Award is a good thing because you get attention, the book gets attention, and I'm sure that people buy books just because they're nominated. And of course, if you would go on to win, it would be a great thing. And I just wondered, you think about how if you manage to continue to be successful and be published and get people to read your work and become better known, and what ways that might change your life?
I don't think it would do anything substantial because I'm, you know, I try to stay sort of even. I mean, I think one of the things that always impressed me is the last moments of the movie Patton.
Mm-hmm.
And in this movie, George C. Scott, after everything, Patton, after everything he's done in the war, there's a voiceover, and he's walking his dog, and he talks about what happened to Roman generals. They would come back from victories, and there would be these tremendous parades, and the general would be in a chariot, and behind the general would be a slave, and that slave would be whispering, and they're going through the streets with this wonderful parade.
And so everybody's cheering.
Yes, everybody's cheering and everything. And the slave, his job, his only job was to keep repeating, "All glorious fleeting." And one of the things I will do, I don't have a DVD player, and so I'll get one of those. But I don't have any desire to do to buy a car. There's no car out there that I really want. I've been living here 20 years, and they've had a succession of people above my head who've been walk heavily for the last 4 years, and my plan is to find another apartment, and maybe I might, might do a tiny bit of traveling. I like snow and everything, and I like to find myself in a bed and breakfast somewhere at a window and reading in the morning as the snow falls, and then watching videos in the evening as the snow continues to fall. And that's about it. I don't have any desire to do much beyond that. I like to live my life simply because all glory is fleeting.
Well, I know, just as a final question, I know sometimes writers don't like to talk about this, but what are you working on now?
Well, that's easy enough, because when I had the novel, and I didn't know what I had, of course, but I had about a collection of stories that I also been working on in my head. And I thought maybe somebody might want the novel, but I was afraid that they would not want the stories. So I had my agent say, well, if you're going to buy the novel, then you should buy these stories that he's also working on. So I'm working on those in my head, and I have to turn them in February. And so that, my hope is I can get that, and they want to have them out next fall. So that's what I'm working on now.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. I certainly appreciate it, and it's a very powerful book, and it's got some really nice writing in there. So I would certainly encourage people to look for the book. It's titled The Known World by our guest Edward Jones. It's published by Amistad. It's a division of HarperCollins, and is just recently published. Is out in the bookstores now. And again, I certainly wish you the best, and appreciate you giving us some of your time.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for inviting me.